ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Caitlin Long, the chairman and president of Symbiont, the market-leading smart contracts platform for institutional uses of blockchain technology. Caitlin is a Harvard Law School alum and a 22-year Wall Street veteran who's been active in Bitcoin since 2012 and blockchain since 2014. She served on Morgan Stanley's internal blockchain working group from 2014 to 2016. During her career, she started and ran three new businesses, was a top-ranked equity research analyst for the life insurance sector, and worked directly for the co-CEOs on a business restructuring in Zurich. She currently is responsible for commercializing Symbiont's technology, encompassing business strategy and client relationships. She continues to help securities industry players, Fortune 500 executives, and regulators to see the benefits and uses of blockchain technology. Markets Media recently awarded her its 2016 Woman in Finance Award for Excellence in Blockchain. An institutional investor named her to its list of the most influential people in pensions during her final 3 years on Wall Street.
Since financial transactions and the models are really intangible and confusing to most people who are not involved in the financial industry, would you mind telling us what is blockchain in layman's terms?
Yes, and thank you very much for having me, Gabriella. Blockchain is a fancy new kind of database that allows all the different parties who use that database to see the exact same information at the same time. And so what it means is that when you have situations that multiple parties rely on the same data, they don't have to keep their own copies of the data and reconcile them, which is what they do today. And so the use case is obvious to financial services where you have lots of different parties, but of course it's much broader than that as well. It is useful for healthcare. It's useful for any kind of record keeping. I just heard of a use case in compliance record keeping, manufacturing companies keeping track of their supply chain inventory, for example. Lots of applications outside of financial services, but it just happens that financial services is the place that's getting most of the attention today.
So how does information, I remember dealing with databases back in the day when I was a consultant, and the reconciling was always a nightmare because we'd have somebody had changed the database, somebody somewhere else had changed the database, and there was a conflict between the two because they'd changed them too close in proximity of time, and the reconciling was a nightmare. But
sure.
How in blockchain, how is it that everything is populated instantaneously? So information is instantaneously, it's all the same everywhere?
That's right. And even though the internet, of course, has latency, so that information won't always arrive at the same time, these protocols are what's called deterministic, which means that for the same given inputs, they will always reach the same output. So they know that they are in sync, and there are fancy algorithms behind the technology that create consensus among the different participants in the network. And so what that means is that there is consensus on the so-called golden copy of data, and all of the different parties who share that data can rely on the fact that that data is legitimate, it's valid, and also there's a perfect audit trail, there's immutability to that data.
Well, I had another question, and it had to do with regulation and location, because it almost seems like the data is everywhere and nowhere.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, what regulatory rules, and obviously with banking and financial transactions, some of them, money transmission rules are really old. They're creaky. They go back to, horse and buggy times, right? So how do we make sure that the regulatory environment makes sense with the actual environment? How is that reconciled? And then whose regulatory environment? Is it the U.S.? Is it some is it some consortium of banks around the globe? I mean, and then is it one of the things when I've read up on blockchain is the idea of decentralizing. And so it's the people's banking system. It's no one government's banking system. And so there's sort of a definite kind of, in one segment at least, a sort of a political spin on it. And so, which I could imagine some governments who like to control a lot might bristle at. So how does regulation and locus of control square with blockchain?
Yeah, that's a great question as well. The answer is the technology is supranational. It doesn't belong in one place. It is the internet, which itself is supranational as well, but it fits in with national and local regulations. In part because financial services is the most regulated industry in the world, and the reality is big businesses and even small businesses are very likely to continue to use the regulated financial services industry because that's where the liquidity is. Last I looked, you could move about $25,000 in blockchain in Bitcoin a day without moving the Bitcoin price. I'm sure that number fluctuates around with different liquidity in Bitcoin, but you know, anyone who's moving a lot of money is not likely to use Bitcoin to do it. So Bitcoin itself is still a pretty niche-y little supranational payment system, and you're absolutely right, it's decentralized. I'm a big fan of Bitcoin. I happen to believe that that is the way money's going to move. But I think it'll take 20 years to get there. And in the interim, the permissioned regulated financial services industry is where most of the action is going to be. And so it's easy because these are nationally regulated banks, for example, if we're talking about payments, or nationally regulated broker-dealers, if we're talking about securities firms, that will be deploying this technology and therefore doing it within national regulations.
So blockchain is the network and the process, and Bitcoin is the currency?
It is. Bitcoin was the first blockchain, and some would say the only true blockchain. I would quibble with that, but the so-called Bitcoin maximalists think that the other blockchains can't possibly be as secure. And it is fair to say Bitcoin literally lives in the open source world with no central entity running it. It has had every hacker try to attack it, and it's got about a $15 billion value, right? That's quite a hacker's bounty if somebody figures out how to break it. And yet nobody has. And in fact, the way the incentives in Bitcoin work, for somebody to go rewrite this morning's history, much less the entire history of Bitcoin and steal all the Bitcoins, would require so much computer power that it's too costly and the cost benefit doesn't make sense. So the incentive structure in Bitcoin in and of itself is very interesting and a big part of the reason why it's such a secure network. But Bitcoin is a small part of the overall blockchain opportunity, because what happened is after Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever he is, created Bitcoin and it started to take off, a number of people in the computer science industry recognized that what Satoshi Nakamoto did was combine technologies that had already existed in a way they had never been combined before. And therefore, other people could combine those technologies in a similar, if not exactly the same way, and achieve a lot of the benefits of decentralization, achieve a lot of the benefits of the shared mutual ledger concept where everybody sees the same data at the same time.
I understand the open ledger. I understand the decentralization of and the universality of knowledge, and I can see the applications of that. But I'm still having a little bit of confusion around the money piece and for people like me, who have not been studying this for so long, if Bitcoin is essentially another blockchain for which Bitcoin is the currency, but the raison d'etre of a blockchain doesn't have to be currency.
Bingo.
Okay.
Yeah, you got it. You talked yourself through it.
I'm impressed. Give me a
exactly.
gold star.
Exactly. Anything that for which ledgers are used, it can be tracked via a distributed ledger, a blockchain. Or a mutual shared ledger is another term that I've heard. It doesn't have to be money that's tracked by these ledgers. It could be shares of stock. It could be medical information. It could be the number of widgets in a supply chain. It could be music. It could be online video. So it creates a peer-to-peer network for basically data that happens to be music or video. There are a number of open source projects. And one of the ethos, I'm not sure what the plural of ethos is, in this community is that there is an awful lot of open source technology shared, because by definition, these are all networks. And so you want to create network effects. And mm-hmm. in the case of the music and video use cases, it's open source technology. So it's a little bit of a weird concept to get your head around, that there is no movie studio producing the movies. It is Joe Schmo films a video and decides to put it up on this community called Singular DTV in the case of video. And if people decide they want to watch it, they pay whatever he's asking for to watch it. So and it's because of the fact that this blockchain technology exists as the middleman, that you don't need a big entity as the middleman.
But is there an interface? I mean, what's the UI? Who designs that? And is it a uniform experience from an interface perspective? If I go to Joe Schmo's movie or I go to Sally Smith's movie, you know, or is it the sure. same interface? Is my user experience the same?
It will be, and these projects have not yet been released yet. The music one is called Ujo Music. So yes, there are software companies that are updating the software for the network and taking a tiny piece of the transaction volume, is what I understand of mm-hmm. the business model. But they're not, all they're doing is updating the software. They have no control over the content. They can't even see it. They have to be paying customers just like everybody else if they want to see it.
What does this mean for, I mean, again, so when we were talking about regulations earlier, so if you have terrorists who are uh-huh. uploading videos and, you know, what, is there no accountability, no responsibility, no mechanism by which perhaps antisocial? I mean, I agree. Like, yeah. Well, who defines, who decides what's antisocial? Who decides if something should be censored? And yet there are sort of broad things to do with pornography or children and trafficking or, you know, sort of the malfeasance. How do you make sure that, you know, I think it's wonderful for artists, but how do you make sure that bad actors don't hijack the platform?
Yeah, you asked the slippery slope question, right? And I think this is exactly what the big social media companies are grappling with, right? I just saw this morning Facebook released a new policy regarding fake news in Germany. So they're going to be going through and creating and determining what's fake and what's not. So the flip side of having the right to censor is that you don't know who's censoring. But the flip side of not having the right to censor is that you can have bad actors. You're absolutely right. And that said, these networks require a cryptocurrency to be posted, which means they are traceable through the cryptocurrency because there are wallets associated with them. And by definition, there's a network identity involved that can, in many cases, be traced back to the people involved. And that is how some of the big prosecutions, there have been a couple of famous prosecutions in the Bitcoin world relating to the Silk Road early on. The right. FBI was able to determine who it was that was running the Silk Road. But not only that, the FBI agents, I believe they were FBI agents, who were involved in that investigation, stole some Bitcoins themselves. And the FBI was able to determine that those agents stole the Bitcoins and arrest them. So
earth, given that we had this earlier conversation about how robust the security was, how did they steal the Bitcoins?
They didn't realize that the cryptocurrencies are traceable. So again, the cryptocurrencies are in a completely different world than what we're talking about for institutional financial services, where we're not dealing in money, we're not dealing in payments. In these other networks, what we're dealing with is, you know, a syndicated loan where all the banks are sharing the same loan agreement, right? You want to make sure that only the banks can see what's in that loan agreement. You don't want everybody to be able, especially competitors, to see what the terms of the loan were. So you've got to be able to encrypt the data and have that data survive quantum computing challenges and forward secrecy, to throw some terminology at you. So you're absolutely right. That all has to, the privacy has to be maintained.
Right. Now, could blockchain technology be implemented to enhance security of content so that it can't be as easily pirated?
You betcha. That's exactly why this is so favorable for the creators of content. And ultimately for the users of content too, right? Because there is no middleman that they have to, you know, pay a cut to implicit in the price that they have to pay to see the movie or download the song. But yes, that's one of the big benefits to the creators of content, is that it can't be pirated. Once you pay to get the right to view it, but it's not downloadable. And so there's a much better concept of fairness. In fact, I think a lot of the media will ultimately migrate to this architecture because it is safer. It is clearer to determine who saw it. If you're not permissioned, if you didn't pay to see it, you don't get to see it. But by the way, the price of viewing all of these things is I think going to go down by a lot. Yeah, well, the content makers make more.
Well, that's where I was wondering, because way back when Bill Gates, back at the, you know, beginning of the internet, his prophecy about, you know, it's going to be about the content creators, but the reason that paying for content didn't work was because it wasn't practical to have micropayments, that this just, there wasn't really a mechanism. And it sounds like this allows and creates a mechanism for micropayments. Yeah?
Absolutely. That's a big part of the concept.
And so from a practical standpoint, I still am having trouble connecting my cash, my actual dollar in my pocket, to whatever the transaction is. Would it be a linkage between my Visa card and the blockchain with the entertainment, and it just accumulates micropayments until it's a certain amount, and then it hits the card? Or how would it work?
Yeah, so in those networks, you buy a cryptocurrency called Ether. They're built on the Ethereum network, and you can buy them on exchanges online. There are many dozens of exchanges that will allow you to connect your bank account. So again, these are regulated. Mm-hmm. So you're going through, it takes a week typically to get an account set up on one of these exchanges, because they have to go through their know your customer and anti-money laundering processes. But once you get it set up, you can buy the Ether directly from your bank account. And then once you have the Ether, that's what you use to pay to see the content. Now, I think, you know, that we're at such early days in all of these networks. If they take off, they'll figure out how to allow you not to realize that you're using Ether to pay for these things. There's a company called Abra that through a trading strategy guarantees that your foreign exchange is always going to be a certain amount in dollars. And you don't know that when you're sending a payment overseas to, for example, the Philippines, you don't know that it's actually going through Bitcoin. You never, ever see that. All you see is what your dollar balance is. And so I think the user experience is going to improve over time as we get more and more of these platforms up and more liquidity in these cryptocurrencies. As well, the cryptocurrency point, again, it's sort of a side point, but it's an important one, because the micropayments use case is a very promising use case, and it turns out that it's not really a U.S. or a developed world use case. It's mostly a developing nation use case. Wow. One of the big providers in this ecosystem told me that he's been surprised that they actually, their biggest growth opportunity is emerging markets. And the reason is that 1 million people a day are getting their first cell phone in the world. And they don't have bank accounts. And they may be miles away from a bank, but the universal money is Bitcoin. And through word of mouth, and in fact, actually, this particular company didn't even have a Chinese language website, yet their biggest customer base was in China. And it was all through word of mouth. People get the internet money, which is Bitcoin, and start using it. And he said, actually, one of the most interesting uses, the first thing that someone in an emerging market typically tends to do when they get their cell phone is they go get Bitcoin and they start gaming with their neighbors because it's a prestige thing. It shows their neighbors that they've arrived and they can start to game with each other and they can afford to do that because they have their new phone.
It's interesting. I had the Omidyar Network, which does a lot of, you know, sort of emerging markets. They've been posting a fair amount around Bitcoin. I was like, why? I didn't get it. And now I get it. Now it all makes sense.
It's not really a U.S. thing, but I believe it will come back and be a U.S. thing. And the more companies like Abra who can mask the fact that there's a cryptocurrency in the plumbing behind the scenes.
Oh, yeah, I think
because
I think that is something that people will, you know, the minute you say cryptocurrency, it's like, right, I don't think I'm going to do that. I think that feels a little too sci-fi, doesn't really
go. I agree with you, yeah. Especially in the developed world where people are comfortable using dollars and euros and very comfortable with digital money using, you know, swiping a credit card or just paying for your coffee with a phone. I pay for my salads every day with a phone.
Right.
So that's what the millennial generation is used to. And I think there will be applications where the payments companies figure out how to use, just like we're doing in the banking system with and the security system, using blockchain as the plumbing through which things move, creating newer and cheaper and fairer and more transparent rails to move assets. That will happen in the payments world as well.
But what about the vested entrenched interests? I mean, you know, why would Visa be like, yeah, I'm going to give away 4%? Like, there's a certain amount, I would think, there's a certain population who doesn't necessarily feel the benefit of the change. Does everybody have to move because, like the internet, it's just coming and you've got to surrender to it? Are there going to be people who lobby against it? Could they ruin it? Would something like net neutrality cause a problem for it? You know, what are their concerns?
Sure. As with any disruptive technology, you've got the incumbents that will try to fight it. But one of the interesting things about blockchain is that a lot of folks initially thought the banks would fight it. And guess who the early adopters are? It's the banks. And if you take Visa as a perfect example, they have publicly disclosed that they're exploring using blockchain for B2B payments, business-to-business payments. Visa is a consumer payments company, and they are trying to figure out if this is a backdoor, cheap way for them to get into the bank's business directly, which is business-to-business payments, and have more payments running over their system, but using a blockchain, so much, much cheaper. So they're looking at it as both offense, and I'm sure they're looking at it as defense as well. But the offense is new business opportunity they've never been in. Whereas the banks, you know, in the B2B payment space, when they see Visa is looking at doing something on a blockchain, that puts the banks on the defensive because the fat profits they've been making off running these payment systems are now at risk. And yet we're seeing that type of behavior all throughout the capital markets. Mm-hmm. There are both offensive and defensive plays in this blockchain space. And it's been fascinating to see who's been involved. One of the biggest announcements of deployment of blockchain technology came from the firm that a lot of folks acknowledge doesn't need to exist anymore in a blockchain world. It's called the Depository Trust Corporation. It's not a company most of us have ever heard from, but it literally owns 99.99999% of the securities outstanding. It's the record owner of securities. So when you buy a share of Apple stock, you're not buying a share of Apple stock, you're buying an IOU by your broker dealer who has an IOU indirectly from the DTC that's the owner of the stock.
Right.
It's a crazy labyrinthine system. There's no reason why it should exist like this anymore, but it's a fluke of history that it does exist that way. So a lot of folks said, well, gosh, there's no reason for the DTC to exist. And so yet, guess who made a big splashy announcement that they're deploying blockchain? It's funny.
Well, but are they doing that as a way to continue their intermediary role?
Yes, that's exactly
it. So in some ways, isn't that a bit of a gnashing of teeth by the designers? Because it's like, wait a minute, we're eliminating you and you're not going away. You know, that seems counterintuitive. And is that going to be the kind of thing where, like with a music, you know, where the labels are like, oh, we're going to get into blockchain. Don't you worry, you silly artists, we'll take it over. And then the whole point of the exercise becomes frustrating.
I see your point. Again, a great question. There is some aspect of, because blockchain is cool, that companies want to be cool, and they're saying they're in blockchain, but they're not really changing workflows.
Right.
And I can't speak for the DTC, but I know of a lot of the use cases that are coming down the pike in 2017 where that's exactly the case. It's basically a situation where, hey, a blockchain is going to do more cheaply for me what I'm already doing. I'm not really redesigning workflows, so I'm not really getting the most benefit from this technology, but I'm going to go ahead and deploy it because it's cheaper, and then I'm going to plant the flag and say I'm in the blockchain world.
I'm going to make sure that I'm in the blockchain world, so as an intermediary, I can't be eliminated. That I'm going to keep the process, the macro process. I'm going to keep my place in it, because if I don't jump in, then I'll be eliminated because there is no need.
It depends on the use case. It really does. And so you're going to see banks deploy this year some that are what I call the incremental blockchain uses and others that I would call the transformational blockchain uses. Mm-hmm. And you'll see the same banks doing both.
Okay.
It very much depends on the use cases and whether there's a compelling justification. I will say, talking to the banks, there are compelling justifications to do each and everything they're trying to do. They're not just doing it to plant a flag.
Uh-huh.
Of course, they'll get some PR benefit for it, because this is a hot thing and they want to seem like they're ahead and innovative, et cetera. But a lot of the use cases that are coming out are what I would call incremental. They're not really changing workflows. The transformational stuff, by definition, is going to take longer. And that's coming too. Absolutely, that's coming too.
Right, right. Well, I've used up all of your time.
Thank you
so much. It's been really interesting.
Fast.
And I keep on sort of going in circles in my mind. Like, I think I get it, and then it slips away
from me. That's normal.
But I think it's really interesting, and I really actually think between this and the Internet of Things, the most disruptive forces, I think that in much the same way that the internet and digital world disrupted everything, I feel like this is, we're on the cusp of disrupting everything, and it's incredibly exciting.
It is. And you know what? The Consumer Electronics Show, the big show, trade show in Vegas week of January. Yes, because they have now created an entire day-long track in the Consumer Electronics Show for it, they called it the Digital Money Forum.
Ooh.
And the blockchain sessions were absolutely overflowing, standing room only.
Wow.
So at the Consumer Electronics Show, it's exactly the connection to the Internet of Things that you were just talking about. And once you add an artificial intelligence in with it,
sure,
basically, you know, if you like a certain type of milk and you're running low, not only will your refrigerator order it, it will also pay for it directly, right?
And that what's interesting there is, what does that mean for the brand of milk that isn't currently in your refrigerator, and does an advertisement ever make a difference at that point? The loop has closed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really remarkable where if you sort of start looking at it and what the ancillary effects are, and then beyond that, I mean, it's fascinating. Anyway, got to stop talking.
All right. Great fun.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed speaking with you.
I did too. This is great.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who have helped bring the program to life. First, my friend Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, Caitlin Long. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.